Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
We are still trying to make sense of Bill Huang and what prosecutors charge that the hedge fund investor did, plowing cash into a desperate buying spree to prop up his artificially inflated stocks. As our Matt Levine writes, let's get to it, because Bloomberg Opinion columnist Matt Levine covers finance. He was an editor of Dealbreaker, an investment banker at Goldman, an M&A lawyer at Wachtell Lipton, and a clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. And he joins us now via Zoom in New York City. And I got to say, Matt, we actually kind of want to talk Twitter and Elon with you as well as this. But let's start with Bill Huang, because you have such a great detailed column about what this guy actually did. I mean, what strikes you as, like, just trying to understand, you know, his thinking in all of this?
I just really don't understand his thinking. He had a lot of money. He was a former hedge fund manager. He borrowed a lot more money from his banks, and he spent all of it on buying about 10 stocks. And he bought so much of them that their prices went up and up and up, and like it doubled in some cases over the course of months. And then he just, you know, he had profits because he had bought stocks that were going up, and he took those profits and he rolled them into borrowing more money and buying more of the same stocks. And so eventually something went slightly wrong. You know, one of these companies issued more stock and the stock went down. He got margin calls from his banks because he'd borrowed all this money. He didn't have any money left over. And so the banks liquidated all of his stocks. They went back down and his fund was left with basically nothing. And some of the banks lost a lot of money. This doesn't make any sense. You know, it's not a good trade. Like, if you do this, if you buy billions of dollars of stock and the stock goes up, and you then take money out and spend it on buying a yacht and sailing away, that makes sense. If you just do it and you keep plowing the money into the stocks, including like on the last day when you're getting the margin calls, he's spending even more money buying even more of these stocks. All your money vanishes at the end, and then you just are left with kind of nothing and being arrested.
But the thing is, I mean, strange. As you write, he's a really smart guy. He's been in the industry for years. Is there any other end game that could have happened here? Or was this bound to happen given the way he traded?
You know, one possibility is he did take some profits out, right? I mean, if you read the indictment, it seems like to the very last minute, Archegos was plowing all of its money into buying more of these stocks. Archegos is the entity that he ran. It's his family office. But could he have taken money out of Archegos at some point and like buried it in the backyard? That's possible. Another possibility that someone suggested to me is that, you know, a lot of the stocks that he was buying were heavily shorted stocks. And it's possible that he was trying to do a short squeeze where eventually the short sellers would have no choice but to buy back the stocks, and they'd buy them back from him at even higher prices. And he'd make, you know, tens of billions of dollars. That seems like a very strange trade to do in this size and for that long, but, you know, it's one thing he could have been thinking.
If you could sit down with him, fly on the wall or something, or in a conversation, what would be the question you would ask him? Because as you said, smart guy, knows how the market works, and
I would ask him what he thought his end game was. The other possibility, by the way, and this one sort of sounds absurd, but is in some ways very straightforward. The other possibility is that he just thought these stocks were really good stocks, and he thought they'd go up, and so he bought as much as he could of them. The indictment, if you read like what the SEC and the Justice Department say, they say that he had stopped talking to his investment analysts and he just spent all day with the traders to buy more and more stock. And he didn't really care about what his research analysts said about these companies. But like, you know, one possibility is he thought these were just really good stocks and he wanted to buy as much as he could of them.
So does that tell you in the government's eyes he didn't necessarily think they were really good stocks because he wasn't doing
the government thinks he didn't think that. I mean, like, it's a weird thing because like he's charged with market manipulation and it's very unclear what that is, right? Like if you buy stocks and the stocks go up, someone could say that you manipulated the stocks, but also just anytime anyone buys stocks, they're likely to go up, right? Buying pressure is what makes stocks go up.
Right.
And so the difference.
If I buy a stock, I kind of hope it goes up.
Well, certainly you hope it goes up. But if you buy a lot of a stock, your buying activity itself will push up the stock.
Because of supply.
But that doesn't make it a crime. Like, well, exactly.
Our June Grosso, our legal analyst and who hosted Bloomberg Law, she said, I don't understand exactly what he did wrong. He was buying shares. Yeah. Like, you understand the lying and stuff, right, to regulators, not so good. But
yeah, the question of whether it's market manipulation is just one of intent. Like, if he was sitting there thinking, I'm going to buy these stocks to make them go up, then that is, I think the government would successfully argue market manipulation. If he was buying the stocks because he thought they were good stocks, even though they then did go up, then it's not market manipulation. And often in these cases, you see like chat logs where people are just typing to their buddies all day, I'm manipulating the market. Hope I don't go to jail. And you don't have that here. And maybe they will, right? Maybe they will find evidence of his intent. But as of right now, and they have cooperators and they've, you know, invested and they've like gotten some of the transcripts of his messages, it doesn't seem like there's anything like that where he's saying that he's doing something wrong.
Hey, just got 40 seconds real quickly. We did get a headline earlier that Musk's Twitter share purchases under an FTC probe, according to those in the know. What are you, real quick thoughts on Twitter, Elon Musk?
I don't know. I mean, I think that every big merger goes through some sort of antitrust review, but I would be surprised if there is a big issue here. But I don't know.
All right. Do you think he's going to ultimately finish the deal?
I do. I don't think it's 100% probable, but I think people are underestimating how locked up the deal is and how likely he is to get the financing. I don't think it's by any means certain, but I think he is much more likely than not going to complete the deal.
Well, we love reading your columns. We learn so much. The way Tim came into the studio, he was like, the way Matt lays out what Bill Wong did just really made so much sense.
Yeah, it just made sense to me, Matt. So definitely appreciate you taking the time to join us. Matt Levine, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, joining us via Zoom from New York.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
I got to say, Tim, it's not easy being a company today. Employees and consumers and customers and investors kind of wanting you to take a stand on important issues sometimes.
Yeah, and then there's the whole, you know, maybe quote-unquote problem of high-level executives using Twitter.
Yeah, it doesn't always work out well, despite what Elon does.
Well, that's sort of we're talking about this because, if you recall, it's a story that centers around a Levi's executive. You might have heard of her over the last few months, who's no longer at Levi's. Well, our own Claire Siddeth, a columnist at Bloomberg Business Week, who joins us now on the phone from Brooklyn, is the author of that story, Levi's Finding Itself Thrust into the Culture Wars by a Rogue Executive. Joining us now is Claire, along with Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. Joel, I think for a lot of people, they might not know the name Jennifer Tsai, or did not know it until just a few weeks ago. Despite the fact that she's been a high-level executive at Levi's for quite a bit of time.
Yeah, Jennifer Tsai rose through the ranks at Levi's for years, actually, and eventually became a brand president and was in charge of Levi's marketing. She was the chief marketing officer. So it would basically set her up to be potentially the next CEO at the company. And she was very, very good at her job. And where the rest of the world, maybe you've heard of Levi's and since it's, you know, basically a old school Americana brand that she helped turn around, frankly. But if you hadn't heard of Jennifer Say, you may have when all of a sudden in February, a spat between her and the company became the reason that she left. And that made us very interested in her. And Claire Suddeth immediately started going on a bigger story. And what she found, I think, is pretty remarkable. And it's really this complete tale of Jennifer's sort of transformation inside Levi's. And it also gets to a bigger story that I think we're all really interested in right now in corporate America, which is this tension between companies, their images, the tension that social media creates. And you just think of Coke, Disney. Now, this, we'll talk more about Levi's here. This is a challenge for all kinds of American companies all of a sudden. So, Claire, tell us about Jennifer and what you learned. Obviously, this was all over the headlines, but you dug deeper. What did you find out?
Well, you know, like you said, Jennifer was the head of Levi's marketing. So all the advertising, marketing, branding, Levi's, that's what she was in charge of. The company for years was also incredibly progressive, you know, way back until the 1930s, you know, it more recently in the past like decade or so, they've come out in favor of gun control, you know, marriage equality, transgender rights, et cetera, et cetera. And she was also part of the executive team that sort of shaped that narrative and talked about, you know, when it was appropriate for Levi's to say something and in what way. But then during the pandemic, you know, we've all found the pandemic really hard and she was stuck at home with four kids. And so she started tweeting her views on COVID, but they were, I would say, rather contrarian. I would say as early as April 2020, she was calling for the country to open back up. Her pet topic was school reopenings, which, you know, now kids are back in the classroom now, but in 2020, when no one really understood the virus, it was much more controversial. And, you know, within Levi's, employees started to become really upset and saying internally to HR, to legal, the CEO himself, you know, why do we have an executive who's saying all this stuff on Twitter? Some of it is in direct contradiction to company policy. And it was like a 2-year-long internal struggle of Levi's trying to handle this diplomatically internally. Ultimately, it told her she couldn't hold her position as brand president and she'd never be CEO. And so she quit in a very dramatic fashion and said that she had been silenced.
So what's interesting, Claire, too, I mean, as you note in your reporting, I mean, Levi's is known for being a pretty progressive company for years and taking positions on controversial issues.
Yeah. And that was sort of Jennifer Say's argument is, you know, Levi's speaks out on so many things. Why was it not okay for me to speak out about COVID? But I think, you know, the issue is really, you know, one executive going one way and all of these employees, to sort of rank and file employees saying, we do not agree with this. We don't like this. You know, they had town hall meetings. She went on Laura Ingraham's show on Fox News. People didn't like that. And they were saying, you know, why is the Levi's executive talking to Laura Ingraham when Laura Ingraham has explicitly said things that this company stands in contradiction to, you know,
Can I just jump in? Like, yeah. Didn't she know she was going to get into, no offense, but she seems like a pretty smart lady and understands branding and marketing. Didn't she understand, despite understanding it was a progressive company, know that by going on Fox, you send pretty much a clear message and you do because of the company you work for, that it's going to come back at the company, to be quite
well,
fair.
When I talked to her, she said she didn't know really anything about Laura Ingraham. She never watched Fox News. But she was the person who oversaw Levi's advertising budget and just was in charge of marketing and had her finger on the pulse of the culture that it seemed, you know, it required a leap of faith for me to take her at face value and think that was really the case. But that was her claim, is like she didn't really know. She didn't realize why this was such a big deal. And also she said, you know, just because Laura Ingraham has said all these other things, why can't I talk to her about what I care about, which is school reopening? And employees were not having that excuse.
Claire, I'm interested because so many companies find themselves thrust into the culture wars now. What if any, were the takeaways at Levi's after this is all, you know, they get sucked into this fight that they maybe didn't initially want to have? Like, what are the takeaways and what are companies to do?
And just got about 40 seconds. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I talked to Levi's about this, they were like, you know, this is a kind of a unique situation. Most of the time, companies' culture thrown into the culture wars are because the company did something and people get upset, and this is one person internally in the company. And so it was sort of a lose-lose situation. If they had ignored their employees, maybe their employees would speak out and said they listened to them, and then the executive spoke out. I think what the takeaway is this is incredibly hard, and one day you might find yourself faced with a public scandal.
Well, just talk to Bob Chapek right now. I'm sure he has some thoughts on that. A really great story. Thank you so much. Businessweek columnist Claire Sedeth joining us on the phone from Brooklyn. Of course, Jill Weber, editor of Bloomberg Businessweek on the Access Line in Brooklyn. Be sure to check out the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. It is on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com, Businessweek.com, and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Yeah, one part of the story that Claire really gets into in this is Levi's long history of being early when it comes to progressive causes, being the first company to offer same benefits to, you know, same-sex partners.
Jeans for women.
Jeans for women in the 1920s, I think, or 1940s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great read.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at QuickBooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Shares of Mattel, they shot up yesterday, their biggest gain in about 18 months, ending with about an 11% gain. They're up again today, 2%, following their latest earnings report. First quarter earnings last night that topped estimates thanks to Barbie and Hot Wheels sales that defy the usual seasonal slowdown. We are delighted to have back with us Mattel Chairman and CEO Ynon Kreiz via Zoom in California. Ynon, so nice to have you. How are you?
Great, Carol. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. We are going to talk about the quarter, but you know where I'm going to go. We all kind of sat up a little straighter when that headline crossed that there could be a possible buyout, private equity interested. What can you tell us about that?
Well, as you'd expect, we don't comment on speculation, and we're focused on executing our strategy. What I can say is that this was the highest first quarter we have on record, both revenue and profitability. Our momentum continued across the business with double-digit growth in Barbie, Hot Wheels, and Fisher-Price. We have started the second quarter with strong consumer demand. The full-year outlook is also strong, and we expect to grow market share. So all in all, an excellent start of the year, and we're firmly in growth mode.
And I think we highlighted yesterday, I mean, you guys have been on a tear. If I look at, you know, the share price in terms of the moves that you guys have been doing specifically, some would say, and I'm going to push a little bit, that you are setting it up for a sale. Are you talking with people? Are there conversations going on?
Well, I can't comment on the speculation, but we've been consistently growing the company, and this has happened over the last 4 years. You follow the story, so you know that we took our adjusted EBITDA from $126 million in 2017 to over $1 billion in 2021 and guided for yet another growth this year with higher goals for 2023. So this is not a one-quarter situation. This has been consistent delivery and execution on a clear strategy and a clear roadmap. We're tracking well, and we are in a great position to continue to grow the company.
And I will point out that from the end of 2018, the stock is up almost 120%. So investors have certainly noticed that performance and those changes.
Enon, one element that you've had to deal with, just not just over the last year, but over the last few quarters too, are inflationary pressures on the supply chain. We've spoken to you and the company in past quarters about moves that you've made to try to make sure that your supply chain remains intact, what you've been able to do ahead of time, but it doesn't mean you've been immune to higher prices. Talk to us about the pricing power that you've had and how much you've had to raise prices and how consumers are being affected by that.
Yeah, we, you know, given the anticipated inflation, implementing pricing action is one of the things we consider at times of inflationary pressures. We're not the only ones, and it's not unique to the toy industry. And this is something that we've done lately in the second half of last year, and we expect to do that again in the second half of this year. It is important to say that when raising prices, we always keep the consumer in mind. And we're being very thoughtful and very strategic and remain committed to maintaining the right balance between quality and value for our consumers.
Well, you know, what's really great is, I mean, you guys have some old iconic brands. We've talked about it with you before, whether it's Barbie, whether it's Hot Wheels. I mean, it's just one brand after another. But then you have folded into the mix an embrace of all that is new through alliances and partnerships. What is it that really drives growth for you guys? What is it that you say, okay, this is top of mind, you know, in terms of the performance for the company overall?
Well, we've been growing on the toy side of the company very strongly. We expect further growth this year. We expect growth in the second quarter and growth for the full year. We expect our power brands to continue to grow this year, Barbie, Hot Wheels, and Fisher-Price, as well as American Girl. And we expect to see strong growth in the challenger categories. This is where we're not the global leader, but we're seeing tremendous momentum and growth in categories like action figures and building sets. So we are in a great position to grow in the toy side of the company. And in addition to that, we're also seeing great momentum on the IP strategy. This is film, television, content in general, consumer products, digital experiences. And this week alone, we had two very exciting news to share. One is that we partnered with J.J. Abrams to produce the Hot Wheels movie that we are developing with Warner Brothers. JJ is one of the most prolific, respected producers of this generation. Filmmakers in general, is also a director. And we're very excited to have him partner with us on Hot Wheels. And in addition, we also announced, or Warner Brothers announced at CinemaCon, the release date of the Barbie movie, which will be July 21st, 2023. And this film is shaping up really well to be an iconic cultural event. We could not be more excited with the creative execution and vision of Greta Gerwig, who is also one of the most respected and prolific creative filmmakers of this generation, and an all-star cast with Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling, Will Ferrell, Simu Liu, America Ferrera, and many other very strong talent and exciting cast. So expect something very special from the Barbie movie, as well as Hot Wheels, and as well as other 12 films that we have in development.
Enon, I want to go back to something that you said about challenger categories, areas where you're not actually the top of the category. Do you think you can become the leader of the pack in those categories, in action figures, for example? What will it take?
We're seeing tremendous growth and momentum. In the first quarter, we grew by 44% in the quarter, and this is on top of 66% in the same quarter last year. So we're lapping a very strong year with 44% in the first quarter. Within that, action figures actually grew by 75%. So huge momentum driven by our own properties, such as Masters of the Universe, as well as third-party franchises that we manage on the toy side, such as Jurassic World, Minions, and Lightyear. Three big theatrical releases that are coming up in the second quarter and will further amplify our growth in this category in addition to what we do already. So this is an area where we see an opportunity to position Mattel as a partner of choice for the major entertainment companies and owners of big, important franchises to leverage our platform, our capabilities on the design side, supply chain, and commercial execution, and really grow these franchises and manage them as evergreen properties that are not just dependent on a movie launch, but this is where we can bring our capabilities and manage franchises as evergreen IP and continue to create value for our partners.
Well, I think about what you said about IP strategy, film, TV. You guys are already doing it with the Barbie movie. You're going to do it, as you said, with Hot Wheels. And I do think about what's the best way for you to leverage all of that? Is it by doing it as a standalone and just partnering and, creating alliances with media and entertainment companies? Or is there some kind of, going back to our first question, some kind of more significant link up with a specific media house, Disney for the matter, that would make sense and really create some incredible leverage?
Well, our approach has been capital light, in that we don't take capital risk in investing in movies. And that capital-light approach applies also to our manufacturing strategy. What we do on the content side is we partner with the best in their respective field. So we partner with the best distributor as a major studio and the best creative talent per genre, per project. And that gives us the ability to do that at scale and develop multiple projects at the same time and not be limited to one or two movies coming out every 1 or 2 or 3 years. So we can do it at scale, work with the best people per genre, per opportunity across the industry, and have multiple shots on goal with incredible brands and incredible franchises, and still find the right economic balance in terms of risk and reward for Mattel, where our currency, our contribution is the IP, the franchises that we know, our expertise and know-how of those franchises, and making sure that we collaborate and bring our understanding and the nuanced knowledge of these franchises to the table and create something very exciting for consumers all over the world.
All right, Ynon, I'm a little persistent, as you might know, we talked a few times. You are firing on all cylinders. Mattel is firing on all cylinders. And you guys have had, three consecutive years of dynamic, certainly equity growth. And like I said, investors are noticing. So some would say that is a reason, the top perhaps, or at a prime moment to sell the company. Others would say it's, you are talking about more avenues for growth. What would it take to do a deal that makes sense? Obviously, shareholders of the board have to agree, but is it just about price or is it about strategy?
Well, we're here to create shareholder value. We've been very consistent about executing our strategy and always have our shareholders' interests as a North Star. We have been doing it consistently. We see a lot of runway for the company to continue to grow and to create more shareholder value. That's our job. That's our focus. That's what we've been doing, and this is what we are looking to do going forward.
Ynon, give us a time frame for the strategy here. I mean, when you think going forward, what does that mean to you? How many years? How many quarters?
Well, the original strategy that we set out was to grow the toy business and in the mid to long term, execute on our IP strategy. Now, further down the road, we're now looking to continue to grow our IP toy business, IP-driven toy business, and expand our entertainment offering. We have put the building blocks in place for the second part of the strategy, and you're now starting to see the fruit of that work with a release date for the Barbie movie as a first, and more to follow, more to come. We will release on the television side, on the episodic side, we will have 13 series and specials on air wow. in 2022, 9 of which are new and 4 are returning. This right. is a full slate. This is a you know a real offering that will continue to grow and evolve.
So, Enon, to help us help our investor audience understand how much Barbie sales will increase when the movie comes out. How much Hot Wheels sales will increase when the movie comes out?
You know, we haven't outlined that specifically by brand, and it's not something that we typically break down by that at that level. But we all understand that a content strategy, an IP strategy, increasing the touch points and the engagement of consumers with our brands at multiple levels is a good thing. Our approach on the content side, on all of our experiences outside of the toy aisle, was to create quality experiences, quality content that will engage consumers. So when we develop a movie, the approach is not how are we going to sell more toys on the back of this movie. The approach is how are we going to make the best movie that people want to watch.
We know
if you do that well, good things will happen.
We know you have to run. 30 seconds left here. The Barbie movie, have you been on set, seen some of the filming?
I have been on set, and I can only say it's extremely exciting. The quality, the visuals, the execution is stunning. And I came back super excited, and I know it's going to be very special.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to it and always appreciate when you find time for us. Enon Krize, he's Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Mattel. That Barbie movie in theaters July 21st, 2023. And I really appreciated getting some time with us. So much going on. That stock, though, and that company has really been on a tear.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You guys know, right? You've been listening to us, watching on YouTube. We have been all over so many big tech earnings, Netflix. Of course, we've heard from Meta. We heard from Pinterest. We heard from Google. We heard from Alphabet, of course. Who am I leaving out?
I don't know. There's like this is the biggest week. This is our quarterly, you know, Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. The tech Super Bowl. Hey, James Chakmak, I bet. I don't even know if he's been getting sleep. Partner and technology analyst at the asset management firm Clockwise Capital. He is back with
us.
He's
fine. He lives in Miami. They just like hang out. You know, it's not like Wall Street, okay?
You live in Margaritaville. Is that what's going on?
Good afternoon, guys. How are you?
Oh, sorry. It's very serious. Very serious.
All right, all right, all right. So talk to us about what we've gotten so far. Netflix. Can we go back to Netflix? I'm curious your takeaway on all of that and what it means going forward.
Sure. I'd say two kind of big takeaways from Netflix is that, one, you have this subscription saturation in the market. Clearly, you know, we've been a rising tides lifts all boats situation for quite some time, as it relates to services and cord cutting and video offerings from different players. But as competition has increased and attention time spent has remained finite, you know, you are reaching a point of saturation. So investors are essentially trying to decipher, you know, who's going to end up, you know, maintaining the most sustainable growth in this next chapter. Netflix obviously has a big question mark on it. But I'd say if you zoom out just a little bit, the overarching theme for Netflix and tech more broadly is this concept of mean reversion. And what we mean by that is that, you know, you had these growth curves across technology that have been largely predictable prior to COVID. And what happened was COVID pulled forward a tremendous amount of demand for these companies. So you saw growth accelerate well beyond what investors had expected for the companies over the next 5 to 10 year cycles. And then what happened today over the last quarter and this quarter and likely into next is that the growth rates have been decelerating tremendously because you're lapping these huge growth numbers from last year. So really, when we think about, you know, the risk associated with the market and the drawdowns that we've seen, you know, we think it's less about, you know, the Fed inflation rate hikes and so forth, and more about investors having a tremendous amount of difficulty ascertaining exactly where these growth rates will land for these companies on a normalized basis. You know, our investors are thinking, are these new lower growth rates the new normal, or will they revert back to the way things were?
I mean, some of these,
you can make the case. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, James, some of these companies have just been are just beat up. I mean, Netflix down 71% from its highs back in November. You have companies like, until today, Meta shed 50% of its value just this year. Roku down 80% since July of last year. PayPal just getting absolutely crushed. Are these stocks oversold? Are there buying opportunities here?
Yeah, I mean, I think through that mean reversion framework, you can kind of come up with high degrees of confidence on which ones are going to be the winners and losers. You look at a company like Microsoft, right? This is a company where the world completely moved in Microsoft's favor because of COVID, which means that the growth rate is actually, the sustainable growth rate is higher than we had expected prior to COVID. So that's one that's benefiting. The world moved somewhat against Google's favor as competition increased and attention spans moved into other areas. And that one is likely lower than expected. Facebook, even more so lower than what we previously expected, which is why, you know, the stock is down tremendously. And Netflix is also tremendously lower, which is why the stock is also down. But I think you can decipher Amazon is going to be a huge, huge comeback. I mean, it's our number one position, and it's probably the number one most undervalued company in the market right now.
Wow.
And the company that provides the most value for your subscription than any other service in the market combined.
James Chalkmok is with us, partner and technology analyst at the asset management firm Clockwise Capital. You said just before we went to the break, Amazon's your number one position, number one most undervalued company. Explore that a little bit further with us.
I mean, sure. Think about what you get with your Prime subscription for $140 a year. You get six businesses in one when you buy a stock share of Amazon. You get retail, logistics, video, music, grocery, and the cloud. And you're getting it at 3x sales. And when we talk about the mean reversion, this is a company that grew 9% last quarter, but used to grow about 20% revenue every quarter like clockwork. I think by the time they report third quarter guidance, in 3 months' time, you're going to see the growth rate double back up to 20%, and the shares either this quarter, or, you know, beginning next, are just going to rocket off where we are. You know, it's trading at 3x sales compared to Chipotle at 6x sales. So you're getting Amazon for half the multiple as a burrito.
James, where are you going to see that? Where are you going to see that growth? Are you in Amazon? Are you going to see it in AWS? Are you going to see it in retail?
I think it's going to be huge. Advertising is going to be a huge driver. You know, I think that's part of the reason you're seeing the pains at Facebook and to some extent YouTube.
You know, our Bloomberg Intelligence team wrote the same thing, James. They're kind of on the same thinking of you, that there's a lot more marketplaces, including Amazon, that's eating away at some of the advertising budget that has been enjoyed by, you know, a few for a long time, but no more.
I completely agree. I mean, I think it's going to be, and it's so nascent relative to its other businesses. I mean, it's going to be growing in 30-40% range likely for the foreseeable future. Obviously, you have the membership component to it, and the cloud, as reinforced by Microsoft and Google's results, will be growing at very, very healthy rates as well. And retail growth rates will normalize back to pre-COVID levels. So this one, to me, is the biggest no-brainer of the bunch when it comes to big tech.
What should we be looking for with Amazon earnings in just a few minutes when they cross?
The main thing, I think, is that you're going to see better discretion on the expense side. Mm. So I think that's going to be an area of surprise. And obviously, a steeper profitability growth curve as a result of that. But most importantly, the fact that the growth rate is moving back up for that 20% number that we used to have prior to COVID. And once that happens, because they'll fully be lapping things in the second quarter. So I think we're just, you know, days away from seeing those kind of numbers from them.
If they don't see that kind of positivity, is that a little bit of a disappointment to you then?
I mean, in our minds, it has always been when they report 2Q and provide that third quarter guidance in 3 months' time. So I can't say with great certainty that it's this quarter, but I certainly think that the trends will be in that direction this quarter. And at the very least, they'll discuss it, that it's in that trend on the earnings call.
How important is advertising to Amazon? And I'd say this, you know, in quotes, it's a relatively new business to the company.
I think it's important. I think it just shows that it's a proof point that people go to Amazon first.
They're not necessarily Googling the product. They're going to Amazon and they're using the search there to do it.
Yeah. And the proof is in the pudding. So if the dollars are moving in that direction, it clearly means that consumer behavior has moved in that direction and it's not going anywhere. So the one thing I just wanted to add before we go is that, you know, the number one mistake investors make is they tend to underestimate the sustainability of the growth for these cloud-first companies. And it's been done throughout time. The number one example I always think of is Walmart. You know, Walmart from 1969 to 1999 grew 36% year on average for 30 years. I mean, how many people would have thunk in 1969 that Walmart's a company that can average over 30% growth a year?
Right.
For 30 years. I mean, virtually impossible. But it saved people a lot of time because they had the superstores. I think the cloud-first companies of today, the Snowflakes of the world, the CrowdStrikes, Twilio's, Airbnb's, Okta, Amazon, you know, these are companies that can have much, much more sustainable growth rates than people expect. So I think we are in one of the biggest buying opportunities of at least my investing career right at this juncture. And I would say much more so even during the depths of COVID. So right now, it's tough out there, but if you can pick the right horses, there's a ton of money to be made. And the analogy is you're buying Walmart in 1969.
So, all right, so someone's got new money that they want to commit. They're a little freaked out by some of the volatility. So what are five names that you would say, this is where you should commit new money? You might need to be patient. It might be a little bit of a crazy ride, but this is where you should go because it is the Walmart, like you just said, of past.
I'm in Amazon, number one. I definitely do Snowflake. I definitely want to play a security type name. Cybersecurity is going to be critical. That would be a company like CrowdStrike.
Mm-hmm.
I like Tesla here.
Mm-hmm. I do.
After the pullback here.
Huh.
I think this is one that.
Go ahead.
I mean, Tesla is changing the world. I mean, the advantage that they have in production, I mean, they are miles ahead, and it's going to take years and years for others to catch up on the cost effectiveness and efficiencies that they can gain over time at Tesla. So one definitely, and Nvidia. I also had Nvidia because they're involved in everything that's involved in the future.
All right, really quickly, 20 seconds. So Tesla, even with a buy of Twitter, you think it's okay?
Yes, I think it's okay. I mean, it's noise. It's noise right now.
It's a lot of expensive noise, you know.
And the thing is, honestly,
yeah.
They say that Musk doesn't care about monetization, but if you do the things that he says he's going to do at Twitter, I really think that the monetization potential is far bigger for Twitter than it's ever been. So I think, yes.
Well,
no
question. What a treat for us to be able to do a double dive with you. So thank you so much. James Chacmak, he's partner and technology analyst at the asset management firm Clockwise Capital, joining us once again on the phone in Miami.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.